You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get select style selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
I spent $40,000 on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Girl, this thing.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Girl, this thing. Great gowns.
Girl,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And Chelsea, how are you doing? I have to be honest, I wouldn't say scared to record this episode, but I am curious of how you're doing.
Did you think a cleanse would turn me into a homicidal maniac?
Kind of, guys. Chell is on, what, day 7 of a prolonged cleanse?
No, I'm on day 5. It's 5 days. I don't know if you guys have heard of this cleanse. Have you heard of this cleanse?
Of course, because influencers do it.
I don't know how it works, but basically you just eat these weird soups in these bars, but your body is like kind of in a fasting state. So you have like the benefits of a fast, like the energy, the mental clarity, what have you, without literally starving, which I find to be delightful.
I mean, you do enjoy a juice cleanse from time to time.
But to me, juice cleanses are harder than this because with this, I haven't actually felt hunger. With a juice cleanse, at some point, you start to get like a little loopy.
Well, I'm glad your mind is clear to talk about all the dumb bullshit we have to talk about today.
I know, seriously, we have so much going on. But what's up with you?
The listeners can't see, but you can. There are boxes everywhere because I'm in the midst of a move.
But that shouldn't be like too bad, right? I feel like you have very minimal possessions.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. You know why? Like Monica in that one Friends episode, I've shoved all my shit in places you can't actually see.
What, the garage?
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this, Chelsea, but every single piece of merch we've never sold is currently in the garage. The giant and just like that box that we were gifted for season one.
Okay, but that shit is already in Tupperware bins. Like, you don't need to go in and organize it. Put it in your next garage and fucking forget about it.
The other house isn't ready yet, so we must go to a temporary housing place.
You make it sound like a shelter or something. You're moving into a furnished apartment. You're like one of those New York actors that has to come out here for 6 months while they film a TV show.
We'll be in a lovely, newly renovated duplex in North Hollywood.
Great.
Here's the thing. The house will be ready when we are on tour. So it's like, I'm not available to move then. So...
Wow, it's all happening.
Speaking of which, guys, there are still tickets available for our East Coast tour. Boston, April 18th, tickets left. But a few. New York, we still got some tickets for our late show. DC, it is my birthday. Please come to this show. Mostly because the more pressure I put on this show, the more pressure Chelsea has to do something truly special for me that day.
Also, if anyone has recommendations for a good lunch place that we could take Lauren for her birthday, that would be great.
Male dancers, you know, or not. Either or.
I'm not going to have a stripper come out on stage.
Damn it.
I'll figure out something. I don't know.
Philadelphia, April 22nd. We will be in Pittsburgh, April April 23rd. Chicago on April 25th. There are some tickets left. And St. Louis and Nashville. Again, we beg of you, do not make us cancel these shows. I guess we should be coming from a place of like, there's a few tickets left in these cities.
Look, we also could just cancel that show and have a small dinner party with the people that have already bought tickets. Anywho.
Yeah, we were off for a week and a few award shows have happened. I'm just going to say, and I do understand it is award season, too many award shows. I mean, I feel happy for Ali Wong, who is winning for Beef, but it's also like that woman was at the Independent Spirit Awards, the Producers Guild Awards, and the SAG Awards. That was all in one weekend.
Also, how many times can we see the same people win? Because it's only The Bear and Beef that are winning at these things. And Succession, of course.
Yes, I do have to say, I love a person that knows they're not going to win who just doesn't show up.
Oh, what, like Annette Bening?
That was great, yeah. I saw a tweet that was like, wow, Annette Bening is so shady when Lily Gladstone won, but it was just her headshot.
So we have to talk about the SAG Awards a little bit, though. I didn't watch any of the other award shows, but I did watch that because it was on Netflix.
Streaming live on Netflix, which is something that they rarely do. I believe the last time they streamed something live would be the Chris Rock comedy special that we watched last year in Miami together.
Oh, yeah, that was disappointing. I love to see the SAG Awards get a bit of a glow up because it's not as if it doesn't have the same caliber of celebrities as the Oscars and the Golden Globes. Like, it straight up does. It's all the same people. It's just like the shitty award show that's only broadcast on like Bravo. What was it? What did it used to be?
TNT.
TNT. Yeah, exactly. But now it's on Netflix.
Yeah, it's kind of an award show without the ugly people because it's just all the actors.
So rude.
I'm about to say something even ruder. Although watching the SAG Awards does make me realize like these are people that say other people's words.
Yeah, that's true.
But thankfully, Netflix gave us something that E nor CBS gave us for the Golden Globes, which was their own red carpet.
I know. So nice.
And I did not realize until the show started, because it's on Netflix, as Idris Elba, the host, said, you can curse, which is something that I would love to bring into the red carpet. Like, you know, what the fuck is this dress?
Absolutely. I still watched Fashion Police just because I'm a loyal bitch.
Who's hosting that these days?
Laverne Cox. It's okay. It's not called Fashion Police because Fashion Police in itself is kind of like a politically incorrect yeah. thing that like everyone wants to forget about. It is called E! Live from the Red Carpet.
Of course, which is what it was originally called.
Yeah.
Laverne Cox, a great choice to host the red carpet. Thoughts on Tan France and Elaine Weltelroth?
I did think it was a little weird watching Tan France interview people after they had won during the show itself.
But do you know why? They basically had to manufacture commercial breaks into that live stream so that people could go to the bathroom, go to the bar, have a smoke break. That's why that was there.
Oh, see, I like the fact that they played with the format a little, but I would have preferred if they had cut to a group of like four funny gay guys that just like talk about what just happened. Like kind of like if you could access the discourse on Twitter in the show, I think that would be amazing. And it's not different than, you know, like sports commentary or something. See, I would love like someone to actually just comment on the fact that Anne Hathaway cried during Barbara Streisand's speech, like in real time.
That would be a wonderful added feature. And they do have that capability, right? They did that Black Mirror that was like the choose your own adventure one. They could have a just like gay commentary track version of watching the show. The nice thing about in the old days, Live from the Red Carpet on E! Was it was divorced from the actual award show. Now that Netflix is hosting it, or, you know, CBS's show, no one can have mean fashion commentary. Like Elaine Weltelroth at the end, she was like, you know who was iconic on the red carpet? Margot Robbie. And it's like, no. No, she wasn't. And that's okay, by the way. Okay? She and her stylist are tired. They didn't think that the Barbie Cord press tour was going to last throughout award season. They've run out of things.
Actually, Laverne Cox did kind of shade Anne Hathaway to her face by accident. She was like, what a fashionista you've become. And then she was like, wait, actually, you always have been. But I think the problem is that Joan Rivers was way, way too mean.
Yeah.
Like, they had to, like, pull it back a lot. But instead of doing that, they're like, let's just make this a friendlier environment in general.
They've tried every version of host they think could work. Remember, they had Isaac Mizrahi for a while, but then he touched the under boob of Scarlett Johansson, won Golden Globes, and he was out of there.
I hate that he got canceled for that. Not that I think men, even gay men, have the right to grope women's bodies, but the way he cupped her body was as if she was a dress form.
Isaac Mizrahi hosted, maybe this was like 2004, 2003, and he was genuinely asking Scarlett Johansson about the construction of her dress and sort of forgot where he was, and this is my memory, and cupped the underside to be like, how is that being held up, basically? And he was not asked back, but then after the Me Too movement, people found that clip and like re-canceled him.
I don't know. I don't think Isaac Mizrahi is the most egregious of offenders. And you know what? I will defend this man till the day I die. I feel like he feels like my spiritual father in a way.
Do you want to talk about people we liked on the red carpet?
Sure, you can. I literally remember nothing.
I was going to say, I did like what Laverne Cox was wearing. I like that she was wearing vintage Alexander McQueen. It's like, yes, thank you. Someone wear vintage.
I think the jacket was McQueen and what was underneath it was Galliano. But yeah, I like her because I'm sure Laverne is amazing, but it's hard to get really good designers to do customs, even for someone that fab. So I like that she's like, fuck this, I'm not wearing Christian Siriano. I will wear Archival McQueen and Mugler and all of that.
I feel like not enough people clock that Anne Hathaway's blue Versace dress was a nod to Cerulean Blue as she was reunited with Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, that was cute, but kind of weird that they were doing her dialogue. Like, I kind of would have rather Meryl been Miranda Priestly.
And I also couldn't tell if she was going so method, right? Because when Meryl Streep came out on stage, she bumped into the microphone, which I couldn't tell if that was on purpose to sell the bit that she needed her glasses, which is how Emily Blunt and Anne Hathaway
right,
came on stage.
Right, it must have been. I was confused about that too.
That's how good of an actress she is.
Love Meryl.
I also thought Coleman Domingo in off-white, in a pink off-white suit, always incredible. Ali Wong and Iris Van Herpen, which I always love when someone wears her because I feel like that's an often overlooked red carpet designer for whatever reason.
Well, yeah, you have to want to look like a futurist sea creature to wear something like that on the red carpet.
And I gotta say, we need to steal this from Ali Wong because she used a really good photo of herself from the SAG Awards in that dress to promote her new tour dates, which I was like, good.
Good for you.
Now all we have to talk about for like the next 30 minutes is just bad
news.
Let's play the theme.
Bad news!
Only on Every Outfit.
So we watched This Is Me Now.
And I just watched the documentary, The Greatest Love Story Never Told, which, Chelsea, if you can believe it, is longer than This Is Me Now.
Is this different than the J-Lo concert that is now on Apple TV Plus?
Yes, because The Greatest Love Story Never Told is a documentary about the making of This Is Me Now, but as an artistic statement, I think is telling what Jennifer Lopez was trying to tell way better than This Is Me Now.
So for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, This Is Me Now is J-Lo's latest visual album, I suppose, if you want to call it that.
Don't call it a music video, because throughout the documentary, Benny Medina is just there correcting people of like, it's not a music video. And it's like, okay, but it's also not a feature-length film. It is 52 minutes long.
The mere act of watching it feels like an assault on your senses. Like, it is the most distressing thing to look at.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. I guess the story that is trying to be told in This Is Me Now, it's very confusing. And I know you might say, Lauren, no duh, it's confusing. But I'm saying that it's even more confusing than I thought it would be. Like, the muddled narrative she's trying to tell is completely out of order.
I didn't even realize there was a narrative. I thought she just kept dating different gay guys.
All right, we'll get to that. But I mean, if this really is a meta commentary about her love addiction and how she did work to heal herself, the movie should begin with like a montage of weddings that end in divorce, and then she can't sleep, and then she keeps going into these weird steampunk worlds where it's some sort of flower heart factory. And then she's talking about that in therapy. But no, for people who have not watched it, don't worry, don't. We'll tell you about it. Instead, it begins with an AI-generated Puerto Rican myth about the hummingbird. The camera keeps pulling back. It's not the camera. I mean, it's completely created by CGI. Then it's her on a motorcycle on ice being flung off. Then it's the steampunk flower factory. Then therapy. Then all the weddings.
It's a CGI hellscape. There's parts that look like Burning Man. There's parts that are leaning heavily into the Industrial Revolution, the factory shit. And then what in God's name is that Zillow listing from hell that they have the big fight in?
Where it's like gay boyfriend number 5 and they do a dance sequence where he's straight up wearing like a BDSM rope top. That, that glass house of emotion.
You know, the best thing about This Is Me Now is the scenes where she visits her therapist, Fat Joe, because at least in those scenes, we're not being bombarded with these horrible locations.
Fat Joe is the best part of this film. I'll put film in quotes. And I have to say, I think we're going to start a whisper campaign to get him nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Fat Joe did a lot with a little.
I learned so much about his character. He had a wife who kept trying to get a hold of him. He has a myriad of Cosby sweaters. It's great.
One thing that I found so funny about this movie is that there's a scene where J-Lo's friends have an intervention with her, but all of her friends are like 20.
See, to me, that was the most disorienting part. The AI and terrible CGI, I could understand where that came from. But why did she make all of her friends in their 20s? And by the way, having watched the documentary, it isn't explained there either.
Well, it reminds me of when aging male rock stars like don't stay loyal to their original band. They keep replacing them with younger and hotter people so they can then benefit from the cheerleader effect when they're on stage.
Oh, because the people in the audience want to fuck the younger musicians?
Like, I saw Rod Stewart once, and like his entire band was like chicks in bodycon dresses.
I do have a note that just says David Myers money laundering question mark. And this is directed by David Myers, who directed Kendrick Lamar's Humble video. I believe he directed the Bad Blood video. And has this man bought a small tropical island recently? Because in the Variety article, J-Lo says that she self-financed this for $20 million. And my question is, where?
Yeah, like this whole movie I could make on Midjourney.
That's true. Do you want to talk about your bulldog art you're making?
Oh, don't out me and my AI creations. Guys, I don't know. I recently have gotten really into making like bulldog AI art on ChatGPT.
We won't get into this further. Instead, do we want to talk about it is a real worse than all documentary, I'll say, because there is a scene where her team is telling her everyone that said no to this.
Like who?
Ariana Grande, Khloe Kardashian, Lizzo, which Lizzo just did a video and was like, no one told me.
Well, Jane Fonda said yes and Kim Petras said yes, and that's the important thing.
Jane Fonda said this, but this is what she says in the documentary. She calls Jennifer Lopez. She goes, I want you to know that I don't entirely know why, but I feel invested in you and Ben, and I really want this to work. However, this is my concern. Like, it feels too much like you're trying to prove something instead of just living it. You know, every other photograph is the two of you kissing and the two of you hugging.
You know who wasn't there? Leah Remini.
But the rumor is that they had a falling out because Leah Remini was not at the J-Lo Ben Affleck wedding.
Oh, right.
Although that would be way weirder if it was J-Lo, Leah Remini, and then 4 20-year-olds around them in their friend group. It's giving strangers with candy. The arc of this story, if you want to call it that, is legitimately the end of Sex and the City, Chelsea. Because Jennifer Lopez has one final therapy session with Fat Joe. And she's like, you know what? I am better on my own. And then she leaves his office because, again, Fat Joe has to go home to his wife. I mean, a rich interior life for a man that was on screen for 2 minutes. And does a Singing in the Rain-esque dance. And is like, you know what? I healed my inner child. And by the way, guys, for who have not watched it, you know how she heals her inner child? She goes back in time and hugs her previous child self. And is like, you know what? I'm okay alone. Then we are sucked out of this rain street scene, and then we are sucked into a Burning Man Bollywood dance sequence. And then we see a shadowy Ben Affleck, and that's it.
And we got that in the teaser, so of course we expected to see the top half of his face at some point.
The last minutes of the Sex and the City finale is Carrie being like, I'm single, so it's okay. I can have a single room. And then Big's there, and she's like, fuck being single. Here's the love of my life. This narrative doesn't make sense as a J-Lo semi-stan, certainly Affleck trash, so I know this. She was engaged to A-Rod and was with Ben Affleck within weeks of that engagement ending. It's like, when have you ever been single?
What's more distressing is, after the trauma of watching this film, you suffered a trauma of your own.
I went over to Chelsea's house to watch this, and not to dox Chelsea. I parked on the street, and I'm coming down your driveway, and I'm like, wow, this car that parked in front of me is parked really close. Like, what a dickhead passive-aggressive move. I'm like, clearly this is a neighbor that, as a fuck you, was like, I'm going to park so close to you. I'm like, whatever, I'll reverse back. I then get to my car. I go, no, this car backed into my car? Someone had hit my car with such force in the back that it pushed my car forward and hit another car.
Ugh, I'm so sorry.
As if This Is Me Now isn't bad enough, I will always now not like this because it will remind me that my car got hit. There's nothing to pivot to. It's all bad.
Yeah, shall we talk about Trump's foray into accessory design?
Yes. By now, I'm sure you've heard that Trump appeared at SneakerCon to debut not one, not two, but three ugly sneakers. It is interesting that he announced these shoes just a day after he was ordered to pay $355 million in his New York civil fraud trial. Again, Chelsea, not to be confused with the $83 million he was ordered to pay E. Jean Carroll.
You know that Kanye looked at those shoes and was like, bruh, like, what is this? They're so bad. But I find it interesting that he released multiple styles, but the gold sneakers are the ones that have really dominated.
Right. You are referring to the Never Surrender High Tops. Only 1,000 pairs will ever be released.
Well, who knows if they're going to be able to produce these. I mean, these have to be mock-ups. I do not believe that these are real products.
Yeah, because if you noticed, all of these items are listed to ship between June and August of this year, which means they are producing these based on the orders, because Trump is not a man who's going to carry any inventory. Oh god, this box is so shitty too. Sorry, I'm just looking at them. They literally just slapped a Trump sticker over it.
You know what's not weak is the Trump cologne. I kind of fuck with the bottle for that.
Go on.
I just think that having a golden bust of Trump on a men's cologne is just good design. But there's something really campy and shitty about this that actually kind of works.
Well, and there is also a perfume for the MAGA ladies. Thankfully, it does not feature Trump's head, but it doesn't feature Melania's head either. It's just a tea that goes into a very slim but curvaceous bottle.
Yeah, the bottle for the women's fragrance looks like shit.
Can I read the copy? Because someone had to write this. It's pretty good. A crisp opening of citrus blends into a cedar heart, underpinned by a rich base of leather and amber, crafting a commanding presence. Victory is more than a fragrance. This cologne is for the movers, the shakers, and the history makers. Crowned with a Trump collector's cap, splash on a bit of victory and own every room you step into. Victory is very much a collector's piece.
Well, he did that, guys.
Yeah. Everyone is talking about the gold shoes with the red bottoms. I saw that someone online was wondering if Christian Louboutin was going to sue him since he has the copyright on red bottom shoes.
In the sneaker category as well?
Yeah.
Huh.
No one's really talking about these other two shoes, which you can get for the low, low price of $199, that are really for his older set of followers because they're that kind of sock sneaker with like a cushy sole.
It's giving Kirkland signature, but with some embellishments.
Yeah, I have a calendar reminder set for August because I want to know if these actually get sent out.
Shall we transition to something even darker, perhaps the darkest thing we've ever discussed in the history of this show? Where is Wendy Williams?
I do think it is fair to let the public know what is going on with Wendy and certainly the cracks in the conservator system. but a four-part documentary is excessive.
I don't think it should have been released at all. I'm sure there are other celebrities whose minds and bodies have deteriorated like this, but the public never sees it because we shouldn't see it. Like, when I was watching this, I kept thinking, I'm watching something that I shouldn't be allowed to see. Just as a longtime fan of Wendy Williams, it's just so depressing because I know that she would be horrified if she knew that this was out there.
Everyone in this documentary has a lot of love for Wendy, but is extremely exploitive.
I don't know if they have love for her.
I think her family does, but then there are sort of questions where it's like, why didn't they come out to LA? Why aren't they in New York with her?
I don't trust her family. I certainly trust them more than her shady manager, her shady publicist, her conservator.
Who wisely elected not to participate in this documentary or really respond to any request to be interviewed.
Yeah. Her family, I do think that they have better intentions for her than the hangers-on around her, but I question how anyone could participate in this. It seems like they are primarily interested in clearing their name as a family.
And her son letting everyone know that the $100,000 that he spent on his mother's credit card was sanctioned by her.
For those of you who haven't been closely following the Wendy Williams situation, she's always struggled with addiction. And then her husband had a child with his mistress. They get divorced. Her mother dies. Her addiction spirals out of control. She loses her show. There is another Lifetime documentary called What a Mess that came out during the pandemic, which was great because she was still in her right mind at that time. But I believe that's when we learned that she has Graves' disease, which is why her eyes bulge, and lymphedema, which is why her feet are swollen. And now in this documentary, we learn that she has dementia and aphasia, which aphasia sounds truly terrifying to me, which is you can't process what people are saying or communicate back, essentially.
So she has a publicist named Sean, which at one point when Wendy is not in her right mind, she says, go eat something that will make you fat, which I felt bad for this woman until she basically kidnapped Wendy and brought her to Los Angeles for quote unquote meetings about a talk show.
Well, you know, these people are crazy because any management team that was actually doing their job would not allow her to be on camera at all. In this state.
Yeah, I'm so curious about the producers themselves who have now gone on the record and said, oh, it wasn't until Kevin Jr. told us that she had alcohol-induced dementia that we realized that she had that. It's like, I don't know, you seem to have been following around for a month.
They're fucked up too. I don't think that Lifetime should have filmed this. I don't think they should have released it.
At one point, Sean asks Wendy in the back of the car, do you want to go to an Oscar party? To which Wendy goes, who's Oscar? And then Wendy goes, can I wear what I'm wearing? Which she's wearing cutoffs and a Gucci top. And then Sean goes, no, I think we'd have to shop for some fancy outfits. Which I'm like, is this just a way for Sean to buy clothing on Wendy's dime? Like, what is this?
She's a full monster. I mean, all of these people, it's just unsettling.
Once Wells Fargo froze her bank account, I believe the conservator and her guardian was selected by Wells Fargo, by the bank.
And I do think that her family would be better than a conservator, even if they are financially exploiting her in some way, just because the state she was in was so fucked up. The fact that her family doesn't know where she is and can't contact her is so fucked up.
There's a follow-up Hollywood Reporter article that says, yes, it's, you know, oh, this is temporary, but 98% of these kind of conservatorships become permanent. Like, there's kind of no way to get out of them, which is incredibly disturbing.
No, it's super fucked up. And I understand why the family would want to use this as a platform to expose that. But I just can't really trust anyone that would choose to take part in this for any reason.
Yeah, it's a little confusing as to why don't they have their own lawyer. They seem to trust the system, which is blatantly untrustable.
Well, also, none of them had seen her in what?
A year?
Yeah, exactly. Very, very sad, because Wendy is truly one of those people that is just like completely irreplaceable. She had a skill set that no one else, not even any other talk show host really had, which was the ability to just sit on a stage in front of an audience and talk shit about whatever without people writing for her, completely improvisational for hours on end every single week. And I don't think she gets enough credit for how sharp she is and how much of a comedic genius she is. Watching this feels like, I don't know, like Harmony Korine's Sunset Boulevard or something. It's like gothic almost. Also, did we mention that Black China is in this movie?
The part with Black China, Angela, is the most beautiful part. She seems to be someone who understands what's going on and talks to her in the way that you have to talk to people who have dementia, which is give them grace and go along with what they're saying, not fight them. So this documentary was so depressing that I'd like to talk about the Lifetime related commercials that I got when I was watching this.
Oh my God.
Commercials for these Lifetime movies, which sound incredible.
I know. When I was watching this, I kept thinking like, why don't I just watch Lifetime all the time?
I mean, Friday Night Sex Scandal? Based on true events?
Single Black Female 2?
Simone's Revenge?
I know.
Hunting Housewives with Denise Richards and NeNe Leakes?
I know.
Well, Chelsea, we have the story that I'm obsessed with, which might be the funniest bad news of the week, which is the Willy Wonka immersive experience. For those of you who don't chronically live online like myself and Chelsea, this past weekend in Scotland, families were dismayed by an underwhelming Willy Wonka immersive experience. The website promised a journey filled with delicious treats, enchanting adventures, and moments worth capturing, but instead they were greeted with a sparse event hall.
The photos are truly beautiful.
All of the images on the website were created with AI, and they look incredible. It looks like an experience worth going to, and you would imagine the tickets were like $40 or $50 each, that given the photos you're seeing on the website and the ticket price, that it would match the price, but not so much. So the first news story I saw was, it was scaring children that they were crying and the cops were called, and I was like, okay, I mean, it's depressing, but what would scare children? So not only did AI generate the images for the website, they for some reason decided to allow AI to create the script for this immersive experience, which created a non-existent Wonka-related villain. It is legit terrifying. It is a man in a black ghost face robe with a silver faceless mask. It's the worst parts of like Sleep No More and Eyes Wide Shut. And he just sort of comes out of the mirror in a sparse warehouse. It's terrifying.
Horrifying. Also, the photo of the cups of lemonade.
Oh, that's right. They didn't even get chocolate. They just got 2 jelly beans and half a cup of lemonade.
I know the kids were disappointed and that sucks, but as an adult, I would love to be part of a scam like this. And this is a much lower lift than like going to the Fyre Festival or something.
Oh, when you said be a part of this, I was like, good news, Chelsea. We could make a terrible Sex in the City, not affiliated in any way, Sex in the City experience. I mean, we have enough things. We can have it in my empty house. See, what I like about this is we're in this fun time with AI right now where it isn't better than reality. You can tell that it's obviously fake, but that won't last for long. So I just want to revel in this.
Well, yes, but the thing about AI is that people are basically now using it to pitch or sell things that they cannot execute without having some sort of crazy Pixar Kardashian budget.
Very true. All right, have we exited out of bad news?
I don't think so, because I wouldn't say that the new look is a light and fluffy program. Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, it is not.
Well, it was surprising to see Ben Mendelsohn as the lead as Christian Dior. And I saw him on Seth Meyers last week, and he was like, it's not really a fashion show. And I was like, that's weird. Why would he say a show called The New Look isn't really a fashion show? And then I watched the first 4 episodes. I'm like, oh, this is not about fashion at all, really.
I think he's good and certainly lovable as Dior, but like physically, I kind of can't get past it. Like, this man does not look like him at all.
The show begins in 1955 with Christian Dior doing a lecture at the Sorbonne, which seems like the most major event ever. Like, imagine just going to your college and there's a Christian Dior fashion show happening.
But kind of you're instantly like ripped out of that world and into the depths of hell, I will say.
Yeah, because it starts in 1955. Christian Dior's at the Sorbonne. A student goes like, well, you know, Coco Chanel's finally coming back. She's been gone for 8 years, and like, she didn't make anything during World War II, and you did. You designed for the Nazis. And like, the professor's like, whoa, 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 we're not going to ask those questions. He's like, no, I will answer. And then for the next 5 hours, we are stuck in 1944.
Also, based on the title, I would not think that this was as much about Coco Chanel as it is about Dior. And she would hate everything about this, by the way. She would hate that it was called The New Look. She would hate her portrayal, although I think they gave her a pretty generous portrayal. Did we mention that Juliette Binoche is playing Coco Chanel?
I was wondering if that's what you meant. It's kind of like when the royal family's mad at the crown, and it's like, I'm sorry, the hottest people are playing you. Like, you can't be mad.
This show very much makes it seem that while Chanel gathered intelligence for the Nazis and had a Nazi boyfriend, they kind of act like she just like passively fell into this fucked up world. Like, she didn't sort of literally conspire with a fascist regime that was carrying out a genocide.
So that's the central question, right? That's Dior's answer in the show that kicks off this harrowing 5 hour flashback so far. Is he's like, yeah, I did design for Nazis, but like, Coco did other things. And the other things is, yeah, she was kind of a Nazi, question mark.
I really like would give anything to have fashion historians fact checking the show in real time while I watch it. But what makes this more confusing is I sent this article to you. Time Magazine published an article where they interviewed multiple Chanel and Dior biographers about what they thought of the show. And even the two Chanel biographers said different things about Coco.
Another crazy thing that I think speaks to our American education is, of course, in history, when you learn about World War II, it's like, and then the Nazis took over Paris, France, and you're like, got it. You're not really taught what the day-to-day must have been like. This show shows it.
I've seen World War II movies about Nazis, about concentration camps, and about people fighting Nazis. I haven't really seen a story of people that are just going about their daily lives, going to work in Nazi-occupied France.
This show is, again, not really about the new look. There's more Coco Chanel. But it is about Christian Dior's search for his sister, who was a French resistance fighter who was sent to a work camp.
Chanel's nephew was also captured by the Nazis. So they had these parallel situations where they both had a family member that they were trying to save.
Which she used her connections with the Nazis to get him out. The other thing that I didn't realize is she lives at the Ritz.
Look, if there's two companies that don't want you to see the new look, it's Chanel and it's the Ritz. Because it's like, this show is basically like, remember how this legendary hotel was once a hub for the SS? Like, it's wild.
We haven't even mentioned that John Malkovich is kind of doing a French accent.
John Malkovich plays Lucien Lalonde. We're not just getting Dior and Chanel in this. We're getting Balmain. We're getting Balenciaga. We're getting Elsa Schiaparelli has no line, but she's there.
I know. In the second episode, Coco talks about Elsa. I was like, Schiaparelli. And it's like, no, Lombardi. And it's going to be Emily Mortimer for one episode.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, I'm very interested in the subject matter of this show. So I am completely happy to watch this show. But considering how much money it clearly took to make this, the caliber of actors that it has, something's missing. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe it is. I don't really know what this show is trying to say.
Yeah, when Ben Mendelsohn was interviewed on Seth Meyers, it more seemed like the person who created the show read this book and was like, well, this is really interesting that no one knows about. Let's do this.
I mean, I guess it's just trying to say that World War II had a huge effect on both of these designers. But I do think that Juliette Binoche is quite good as Coco Chanel. I want to say that. And this is physically legit, which is what makes the Dior casting a little weird.
It's hard for me to reconcile because I love Juliette Binoche. And I'm like, wow, she's doing some not great things. But fuck, does she look great in every scene.
Did you know that in the 70s, Katharine Hepburn starred in a Broadway musical about Coco Chanel? There are clips of it on YouTube, and it looks like incredibly fucking fab because they replicated the famous like mirrored staircase that like led into Chanel's apartment, but the set rotated. So imagine like a rotating set of the staircase with like dozens of models parading down. Like it looked fucking major. Google this shit.
So can't wait for 4 more hours of downer.
I don't know if it can possibly get that much more depressing than what we've already seen, but we'll see. Anyway, moving on. Speaking of problematic faves, Claude Montana died this week, RIP.
King of the shoulder pad.
Yeah, if you aren't familiar with him, he was a prolific French fashion designer that really peaked in the 80s. He had this kind of like futuristic leather bar look. He made women look insane. Maybe this is a weird observation, but I think that out of every fashion designer, he made women look most like a fashion illustration. Because the shoulder was so extreme, the proportions were so extreme. It's like all of his models, like when you look at photos of his fashion shows, it's like they look like Antonio Lopez illustrations. Like it's really, really wild. You know, I don't think people talk about him enough. We've seen Thierry Mugler kind of get his due on social media and whatnot, but I haven't really seen that happen with Claude Montana. We wouldn't have like a Nicolas Ghesquiere or a McQueen without someone like that.
Yeah, I didn't know until I looked at his wiki page that he married a model, Wallace Franken, in 1993, so he would seem more marketable to buyers. And it feels like this warrants an entire movie.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it's so fucking dark. Because basically, he was always openly gay. He married his muse, this very androgynous model, in this like public ceremony that was very bizarre. And they were married for a few years, during which time he was emotionally abusive, physically abusive towards her. And ultimately, she committed suicide. She jumped out of the window of their apartment. And while he obviously didn't have anything directly to do with her death, the entire fashion world in Paris and all of her friends basically blamed him because they knew he was abusive, and also like because he was gay, like he was obviously still fucking guys all the time and whatnot. It was a very like toxic, sad situation.
Feud season 3.
It could be, especially because another detail about Claude Montana that I love is that he actually was roommates with Thierry Mugler, and then they had some sort of falling out. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of Ryan Murphy-type material.
R.I.P. to a legend. All right, now can we finally exit out of bad news talking about Fashion Week?
Sure. Let's start with Moschino.
All right, what did you think?
I loved it.
First collection by the new creative director.
Yes, Adrian Appalazza. I hope I'm pronouncing that semi-correctly. Yeah, that brand needed a reset so badly because while Jeremy Scott did some really great work there, it hasn't felt like a cool brand in a really long time. And I feel like Moschino is a brand that should be thriving right now because it's a brand that is all about like quirkiness and loudness and surrealism, and all of those things are popular. And I feel like he took the DNA of the brand and made it actually relevant.
Yeah, I think he steered it away from the camp and pivoted a little more towards the surreal. And I mean that in the best way. Like, I think about that. Whenever we talk about Fashion Week, always great for an audio podcast. But the sort of chic Riddler look where it's the question mark and the black button down, and then the question mark continues all throughout the pants, and it becomes a pattern in and of itself, sort of abstracted.
Yeah, and that was an archival reference, but it didn't feel like he was just sort of copying old stuff. I think it's because maybe the silhouette was so different. It definitely was like veering towards oversized, slouchy. So it's like a beige fisherman sweater with like a ruffled cha-cha skirt.
And then gray trousers and then a red like Joanne cowboy hat fedora of sorts. Feels very now, very new, playing with proportions. And very fun, like the smiley face, bright orange mohair angora sweater is like, oh, that's gonna sell. Like, there's also very sellable pieces. He's saying something new about proportions. I thought it was a great start.
His last job was at Loewe, and you can really see that because the clothes are outlandish, but they're also very practical and wearable, and you can see people buying them, and I think people will buy them. Also, I loved the baguette bag, which, not to be confused with the Fendi baguette, this is a bag that actually looks like a loaf of bread. And I feel like the Le Mer croissant bag walked so the Moschino baguette bag could run.
Lots of fun stuff.
Moving on. Gucci, how do we feel? Not well, bitch.
There was a belief when Alessandro Michele left that the thought was that Henri Pinault wanted a more understated Gucci, and that's why Alessandro Michele left. And with this collection, I feel like that's proven to be true, that that is what happened.
Yeah, it's crazy how far the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction.
Did you feel like this collection was giving Bobo Prada?
Not just Prada, many other brands. If not for the handbags and the things that actually have the Gucci logo, I wouldn't necessarily know that this was Gucci, because everything is so safe and commercial, and this is basically what happens when no risks are taken at all.
So this collection was another play on proportions, long coats with short skirts, short play suits with thigh-high boots.
I mean, the most commercial proportions. It's very clear that, like, while Gucci is a huge brand and a well-funded brand, it's no longer like a leader in fashion in Milan. Now Bottega Veneta and Prada are like completely dominating the conversation.
I mean, I guess my last point is, I don't want to sound like Aretha Franklin, but great, great boots, beautiful boots. That's all I got.
Well, one thing I want to say is that when looking at the Milan collections in general, it's like, it was really hard for me to tell a lot of these collections apart because they are all making the same types of clothes. And that's definitely true in Gucci. They're making these glossy leather statement coats. They're making these slip dresses with lace detailing. They're making asymmetric leather dresses, and they all have the same color palette. And this is true of Gucci as well. It's these olive greens and
browns, burgundy,
beige. It's Bottega Veneta is doing this the most successfully. Their show also had this color palette.
They also have, you're right, the same silhouette of jackets. It's almost like cocoon U-shaped coat.
Yeah, it's like there are very few brands that I'm like, oh, that's a different show. I think you can see with a brand like Marni, like, they're very much doing their own thing, and that's cool, and I think that was a great show. But I think you could take looks from all these collections and mix them into other collections, and no one would really notice.
Yeah, you're right. For the most part, a lot of these collections are really safe.
Well, I think a lot of brands are taking inspiration from Bottega Veneta, but what they're not taking is the sort of quirkier aspects of that brand that make it special and different. So Gucci is kind of like the sanitized version of that.
You're right.
Also with Bottega, one thing that I think is nice is, like, although their runway wasn't very diverse in terms of age or body type, the clothes you can imagine on younger people, older people, what have you. The Gucci hot pants aren't quite as versatile. Should we get into Prada?
It was fine.
They always have amazing suiting. They always have amazing, quirky cocktail dresses that would be amazing investment pieces if you're in the position to buy a dress like that. But I don't know, there was something to me about seeing the baseball jackets that freaked me out a little bit, because I feel like that kind of speaks to, like, something that hasn't really entered into the runways, but is very present when you're in a Prada store, which is like the merchification of Prada.
Now, you yourself right now are in a bit of a baseball jacket.
Well, yeah, it's tats. I borrowed it. That's fine. But does a baseball jacket with a giant P on it, like, that's so not Prada. It's very Raf.
It was very, Americana is the wrong phrase, but like the 1960s silhouette that Prada likes to dip into. Sometimes you see that in the dresses. A lot of bows.
I'm the audience for the bow stuff.
Yes.
Because I always love bows. I always love girly shit. But I do feel like I have seen that dress before at London Fashion Week. And that was another thing that's kind of weird, is that we're used to Prada being so ahead of other brands and other trends. Historically, I feel like Prada is always doing like the opposite of what other brands are doing at that time? Or, you know, when a wide pant is out, they're doing a wide pant. When a skinny pant is out, they're doing a skinny pant, whatever. And it was weird to see them sort of throw their hat into the ring during the peak of the beau craze, beau mania.
A lot of looks, a little all over the place. Some of the looks reminded me of like Madonna in the late 90s, like a very tight distressed leather jacket with then like a tweed mermaid skirt.
Okay, so you're thinking of like Olivier Taeskin's, yeah, like Frozen era Madonna.
Yes.
Got it. Moving on to Gay Paris.
Do we want to talk about Dior?
It's hard to talk about it. I don't even know what to say.
The theme, I guess, was Miss Dior. For those who haven't seen the show, just imagine a Ralph Lauren show, but Miss Dior is painted on trench coats, skirts, dresses.
Yeah, and we, of course, associate Miss Dior with the fragrance, but I guess Dior had a diffusion line called Miss Dior back in the day, and this graphic is from that. It makes one think of punk, or it makes one think of like a crude sign that someone would make for a protest.
Many of these looks look like they would be at the bottom two of a Project Runway challenge.
I don't know. I just don't think it feels like very subversive to put that kind of typography on like a camel coat.
Nothing interesting about the graffiti of it. It's not like she collaborated with an artist to reinvent that logo.
I like that it's an archival logo. I just feel like it wasn't successful. Steven Sprouse did this look successfully. This is like a failed version of that. It also doesn't really feel authentic to who she is as a designer. It seems like she's trying to cash in on the sort of logo mania graphic trend.
I just was imagining Natalie Portman silently crying, looking at the show, realizing she's going to have to wear some of this shit in a Miss Dior ad. Because guys, Natalie Portman, who we love, but is in her 40s and has a teenager, is still representing the Miss Dior fragrance.
Having an aging Miss Dior is very campy, though. I hope they just keep this up as long as possible.
And I hope they keep doing those quasi-domestic violence commercials for the ads as well, which is like all the ads seem to be Natalie Portman yelling at an unseen boyfriend, right? There was that crazy one with Sia's chandelier where she's just like, "You love me? Prove it." And it's like, whoa.
And then there was the Janis Joplin one. So bizarre. But I think one thing that we should acknowledge in the Dior conversation is like, there is a reason that this woman has been designing there for so long, and it's because people must be buying this shit. If people weren't buying this shit, then they would have fired her after two seasons. She's been there for how long now? A decade?
Yeah.
You know, it's clearly something that is just not for us, that we just will not understand. But to circle back to my point about Gucci, it's weird seeing a mega brand like Dior not being a leader within the fashion industry and not, you know, pushing things forward and being on the forefront of fashion. Okay, Saint Laurent.
Loved it. I mean, it's like an austere slut, a lot of those looks, like just long sleeves, but super short dresses with built-in garters.
Okay, see, I hated it.
Oh,
so let's have
that?
It out. Let's have it out.
Those are the looks that I liked. I mean, look.
There was one look in the show. What looks?
There were two. There was the austere slut look I referenced, and then, yeah, then it was all just like see-through skirt suits.
Not even skirt suits. It was like a sheer blouse and then a sheer pencil skirt. And they weren't just made of like what we would qualify as normal sheer fabric. They were made of like the material that pantyhose are made out of. So like a level of thinness that is almost like unprecedented for clothing.
Yeah, he has single-handedly brought the trend of visible tits, which is now everywhere. Like the downward trickle effect, not to sound like Miranda Priestley, but it's like, I don't need Mango and Zara to be copying this. Let's go back to having fully lined clothing.
Yeah, or let's do something different with it like Galliano did in the Margiela show.
But which means showing bush.
It's also designing for different kinds of bodies because this show could only be worn by, I don't even think people with a B cup could wear these tops.
No, you have to be shaped like a pencil to wear this
silhouette. And every look is the same. So it's like, if you're a women's wear designer, you can't design clothes that can accommodate breasts. Like, you haven't done your job. I would have been curious, not that I think that every show needs to make a statement about body diversity, because I don't feel that way at all, but I think that it would be a lot more interesting to see, like, can these outfits hold up if someone with a C cup wears them? Seriously.
I'm imagining, you know, those diaper commercials where they pour blue liquid into the diaper to show you which one can take more. I like the idea of like a D cup. We'll try on this sailor on top. This collection also had those U-shaped cocoon jackets. I don't know what's going on, if there's secret meetings going on in the fashion industry.
Look, it's about the power coat right now. And I'm into that. That's not a trend that bothers me. Moving on.
We would talk about the Ro show, but there are no images from the Ro show because...
Oh, did you not see any? Because people did film and take photos.
Oh, did they?
Like, if you look on Twitter, you can see some photos from it.
This is all to say that there are no photos on Vogue Runway because Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen banned cameras and cell phones during their show and gave everyone a notepad, which has erupted a very interesting discourse all over the internet of, is this cool bringing it back to the way fashion shows were in the 70s and 80s and 90s, or is this elitist?
I don't think it's elitist.
It's not. Can I read this Vanessa Friedman tweet?
Oh my God, so unhinged. It's like as if like she's like a 12-year-old whose parents took away their phone.
Yes, she tweets, I would love to show you pictures of hashtag The Row because it was a very good show, but sadly because of their no social media policy, I can't. And then someone writes, as a journalist, what are your thoughts on that? The policy, she writes back, frustration. I don't feel that taking some pictures interferes with my ability to further consider what I am seeing, and I think I am grown up to decide that for myself.
Okay, so you've missed the entire point, and you've even sort of played into the commentary. To me, I don't think this is about them making the Row more exclusive. It's already expensive as fuck. It's already exclusive, but I think it's more of like a commentary on our urge to sort of consume everything and regurgitate it and disseminate it in a matter of seconds. And it's also about how that urge changes the way we experience things in the real world, like fashion shows.
Yeah, her tweet is really funny to me because in a way, it's not about her, but her commentary is part of the reason they did it. But it's really, come on, it's about influencers, right? Your job is dissecting the show. Their job is making content. But because of this whole ecosystem that's taken over the last 2 years, it has forced people like a Vanessa Friedman to become content monsters. So it's like, I'm sorry, but the actions of a few did ruin it for all.
Yeah, I think that Eckhart Tolle would love this show. And I think The Row is so fucking smart because we should mention Prada did do this before in the 90s, but that was obviously pre-cell phone. So very different thing, certainly not a commentary on smartphone addiction. But this has then built so much anticipation for the actual collection.
Right.
Which normally we would just scroll, see the images, and then, you know, forget about it.
Pilgrim collar, got it.
But yeah, I do think to read this as a form of gatekeeping is a little juvenile.
We live in a culture where everything can be seen now, and so to not be able to see something immediately is therefore elitist.
Well, also, The Row isn't a brand that needs it. Some brands, like, legitimately need social media impressions to sell clothes and to generate buzz and to make people care. The Row does not need that. They've never relied on that. They've never relied on celebrities. They just make clothes that, like, classy rich women want to wear, and they're very good at it.
For the longest time, I mean, they started that label in 2006. For a good 10 years, certainly the first five, people ragged on The Row because it was started by the two of them. But they had the finances to keep it going until they lasted long enough that now they are the arbiters in many respects to what a lot of things that are going on in the industry. And I'm curious if people are now going to copy this policy.
Yeah, I think to do the same thing would be a little obvious. I think they're very smart for beating everyone to the punch. And, you know, I was cynical about the Rose prices early on, but then I went to Barney's and I saw a jacket. Not only was the jacket just like the most beautifully cut blazer I've ever seen in my goddamn life, the label was like almost like a mini like abalone shell that had The Row like etched into it, hanging from delicate little chains. And I was like, oh, they're geniuses. Like, this is the most expensive looking jacket I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I do think it's funny when sometimes people are like, you know, there's no difference between a Zara jacket and like the Roe jacket. And it's like, I get it. You could like not want a Roe jacket, but like they're not the same. There is a difference as to what they're doing.
Put some respect on Michelle Tanner's name.
I remember some interview with John Stamos about Fuller House where he was like, yeah, I was kind of hurt that, you know, Mary-Kate and Ashley didn't want to come back for the series. And it's like, why? They don't do this anymore. Like the last time Mary-Kate was in a movie was, I believe, as a cameo in Factory Girl.
Oh, yeah. Who did she play? Someone that was like wildly inappropriate casting, as I remember.
Actually, it just says that she's art gallery patron is how she's listed. Anyway, I can't wait to eventually see the collection.
We've reached the end of the show. There's no Kardashian news, so we're not talking about them. But we want to give you guys a heads up that next week we will be unlocking a VIP episode instead of doing a new episode. And we have our Gilded Age episode coming out on Patreon and Apple Podcasts.
And we will be back the week after that because the Oscars, baby. We got to talk about it.
Fuck yeah.
All right, guys. Until then.
Bye.
Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,